Welcome to Oncology Today, a special follow-up to a CME satellite symposium on the management of prostate cancer held during the GU Cancer Symposium in San Francisco this February. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Dan Petrylak from Yale University School of Medicine in New Haven to chat more about where we are and where we're heading in prostate cancer. And to begin, I asked him about a fascinating new data set he presented at the GU Cancer Symposium on the endocrine agent ARV-110, a PROTAC, which is an orally bioavailable proteolysis-targeting chimeric protein degrader. So before chatting with Dr. Petrylak about where we are today with prostate cancer, I asked him to comment on what we've learned recently about the endocrine biology of this disease and hormonal interventions.
The biology of hormonal therapy goes back many, many years to the late 1960s with a gentleman by the name of Jack Geller who found that resistance developed through the paracrine secretion of testosterone from prostate cancer tissue. And so not only are you looking at the hormonal axis with testosterone being secreted from the testes as well as from the adrenal glands, but the prostate cancer cell itself makes its own testosterone. So that led to discoveries with abiraterone, with enzalutamide, with apalutamide, the antiandrogens. And so the PROTACs are a different class. It's a way of exploiting the body's natural mechanism of degrading proteins. So basically, the PROTACs bind to the androgen receptor, and there are specific mutations that it binds better to. The H875Y mutation is one of them. There are a couple of others. There are at least from the Arvinas drug, there are two different drugs, 110 and 766, which the 766 seems to have more of a broader spectrum of mutations that it binds to. But there are activating mutations of the androgen receptor that will bind different ligands. And these PROTACs will actually degrade those particular variants of the androgen receptor, as well as the androgen receptor itself, wild type. So this is potentially a way of overcoming the resistance to primary androgen deprivation therapy.
So I have no idea if it's related, but it kind of sounds a little bit like fulvestrin in breast cancer, which gets rid of the estrogen receptor. And now we're seeing so-called oral SERDs with the same concept. Is it similar to that or fundamentally different?
It's similar. I mean, they're very effective in the laboratory. One PROTAC can take out as many as 700 copies of the androgen receptor. So it's similar.
Interesting. The other thing, and this starts to lead into some of the clinical research that's been done, is, you know, as time goes on, it seems like we're seeing more and more evidence that you can do better than androgen deprivation alone by adding either abiraterone or one of the anti-androgens to it. And you talked a little bit about some of the potential mechanisms, but I'm going to ask you whether or not it seems like in almost every situation it's being looked at that you do see a greater anti-tumor benefit when you add to androgen deprivation going down, you know, to earlier stage disease. Do you think in general that, you know, this is a greater impact? It doesn't necessarily mean you're going to use it because maybe the benefit doesn't justify toxicity or the cost, but would you agree that in general, it looks like you can strengthen the impact of androgen deprivation and regardless of stage?
Well, I think that there was some intriguing data presented from the Formula 509, I believe, the Formula 509 trial, where apalutamide and abiraterone were added to standard androgen deprivation therapy in a patient who has a rising PSA. And it seemed that compared to 24 months of androgen deprivation therapy in a small subgroup of patients, that this actually may have been a better way to go. So that's got some very, very important implications because now we may not be needing to give 2 years of ADT, which would be more likely to have a negative effect on the testosterone recovery after you stopped it. So that has implications in terms of a patient's overall well-being, muscle mass, bone density. So if we could intensify the androgen deprivation therapy rather than giving longer durations of it, I mean, that's certainly an advantage to the patient.
What about earlier stage disease? For example, locally advanced, I think it was a Stampede study, one of the Stampede study that seemed to show greater benefit when you add abiraterone to ADT. Is that what's being done right now? Are you doing that now?
Oh, yeah. We're doing that now. We've adopted that as our standard practice. You know, for those patients who have nodal disease, have evidence of any nodal disease at the time they are undergoing ADT plus RT, that we do add in a next-generation antiandrogen. So that's another way of looking at intensification in this group of patients.
Getting back to the M0 situation, what about that in terms of primary? We know with castrate-resistant M0 disease that you get benefit by using antiandrogens, but you were just referring to the primary management of biochemical relapse and using hormonal intensification. Where do you see that heading?
Right. Well, unfortunately, the trial was not designed to look at that subgroup, but certainly I could see that heading towards larger randomized trials in intensification versus longer duration of treatment. So I think that those studies clearly need to be done and can have, I think, a significant impact on quality of life in addition to survival.
Right now, in your current practice, what is your trigger to treat a patient with a biochemical recurrence, let's say a patient with a prostatectomy who's already had salvage radiation, or a patient who's had primary radiation therapy? What's your trigger to start treatment in a patient like that?
So it's always been the time frame from their local therapy to the time of their relapse. If it's fast, we know it's more aggressive. PSA doubling time is also something we use. Somebody who has a doubling time of less than 6 months, clearly I'm going to go forth with ADT earlier than later. 6 to 9 months, it's sort of, again, based upon their Gleason score, their ability to tolerate hormones. And if they're longer than the 9 month period, I'm a little bit more, content to watch them for a period of time and see what their PSA velocity is. Now, of course, we have PSMA PET scanning, which helps us to identify potential areas that could be treated with radiation therapy for an oligometastatic lesion in addition to the ADT or potentially by itself. So we have more tools that we can use to potentially treat these patients with hopefully less toxicity.
When you do treat these patients primarily, do you generally use intermittent androgen deprivation?
I think it depends upon what's identified by imaging. Yes, if they're purely negative, I will do intermittent therapy. If we detect nodal disease, bone metastases, obviously, we would step the therapy up to include a next-generation antiandrogen. I think what's in question is in a patient, let's say, who has negative conventional imaging and a positive PSMA PET scan, what's the optimal duration of treatment? How long should we be giving the androgen deprivation therapy? That clearly is not known. That's somebody in the past that I would have treated intermittently. And I think we can use the PSMA PET scans to have some confidence that perhaps we've eradicated those lesions with radiation therapy and hormone therapy. But we still need prospective studies to tell us how best to use them.
What about the choice of androgen deprivation? We now have an oral agent, relugolix. You also have Darigelix, another direct anti-androgen. Just in general, are there situations where you use, or what are the situations where you use either one of those?
Well, I generally like to use an antagonist to start because I don't have to prime the patient with an anti-androgen. So it's just easy to treat a patient with Darigelix or Regulolix, get the testosterone down quickly, and then move forward. One of the things I think is a common theme with the antagonists versus the agonists is that the recovery time to testosterone being elevated is more rapid in a patient who is treated with an antagonist. So if I'm giving a short course of hormone therapy with radiation for somebody who has a PSA relapse post-prostatectomy, that's 6 months is the standard. We want to get them back to the normal testosterone levels as soon as possible. So I would tend to use an antagonist, whether that be oral or subcutaneous with Degarelix. Either of them, I think, would be acceptable. The longer durations of treatment, I think, you tend to have less of a chance of recovering your testosterone the longer out you go. So I'm not sure it makes that much of a difference at that particular point, but certainly I think in the short term that does make a difference.
Do you take into consideration cardiovascular history when you're making a decision? And if so, what specific cardiovascular history, you know, gets you to think twice about what kind of androgen deprivation you're going to use?
Well, there is clear data that shows that in a patient who has had a myocardial infarction within 6 months of starting ADT, prior to starting ADT, that their likelihood of having another event is high if they're on ADT. So I would tend to use that as one of the benchmarks to treat a patient with an antagonist. The other ones, I think, are a little bit less clear, but I think that this is where I think it's important for us to have a good relationship with cardiologists. There's actually a field of cardio-oncology that's developing now. So certainly I think that with firmer guidelines, with clearer guidelines, we certainly should be able to select those patients who are at high risk.
I'm curious about your approach to the patient, again, with M0 disease, but with PSA progression on androgen deprivation therapy. What's your trigger to bring in an anti-androgen or, you know, a novel form of hormonal therapy? And which type of therapy do you generally use?
Well, it's the absolute PSA value and the PSA doubling time. Those are the two factors that help me to add an anti-androgen in that situation. Generally, I like darolutamide, mainly because it has less CNS toxicity. There seems to be, in the studies, fewer falls in these patients. So those two factors, I think, come into play. Often patients will have issues in terms of fatigue on an enzalutamide. Apalutamide is somewhat better, but rash can occur. And when the rash does come, it can be quite intense. So my preferred antiandrogen in this situation is darolutamide.
And I'm kind of curious, do you use intermittent therapy in that situation?
In the castrate-resistant or castrate-sensitive state?
Castrate-resistant, where you're adding an darolutamide, for example.
In my mind, once they become resistant, we go continuously. I think it's pretty rare that we'll stop somebody. The only situation, you know, we've done this in some patients who've asked us whether they can stop. If we find no radiographic evidence of progression, then we've, particularly by PSMA PET scan, we've stopped some patients. It's not really standard at this point, but I think that this is one of the other issues, again, about de-intensification afterwards. We have several young patients who are in their 50s who've said, look, I don't want to be on hormone therapy for the rest of my life. Let's check and see whether these two lesions are gone, and they've been gone. And we've stopped them, and their testosterones have come back up, and their PSAs have stayed down. So, you know, we monitor these patients very, very closely. So certainly that's got a big impact on their quality of life.
But when you do that, you stop the anti-androgen and the androgen deprivation?
Yes, everything.
Interesting. All right, well, let's talk about hormone-sensitive metastatic disease. And I'd kind of like to get your general thoughts about how you think that through. Of course, there are so many variables in terms of the amount of disease, the age, and the performance status of the patient. But in general, how do you think through your algorithm in that situation? And is it different also whether it's a patient presenting with metastatic disease or recurrence?
Well, I think that's probably turning out to be one of the more important issues, whether they have had localized disease initially, then progressed on to metastases, or whether they have de novo metastatic disease. And that's generally thought now that the de novo metastatic disease is the more aggressive form of prostate cancer. But I think that age has something to do with it. Number of sites of metastases, visceral metastases, well, particularly liver, those are, you know, what I would say are high risk, poor prognosis features, more than four lesions on bone scan. Those situations, we will go forth with an Arisense like regimen, you know, giving darolutamide plus chemotherapy, or giving the PEACE 1 type regimen, which is abiraterone plus docetaxel. In a patient who may be frailer, whose lifespan may not be as long, who may not have as aggressive disease, lower levels of disease, we will go according to stampede-like regimen where we would radiate the primary and give abiraterone plus standard ADT. We wouldn't give chemotherapy to low-volume patient. So again, I think we look at the age, we look at the comorbidities. That's important because you know, cardiovascular comorbidities with abiraterone are well known. They've been described by the Jefferson group in castrate resistance. Also, you do need to monitor the patients very a little bit more closely with abiraterone, their blood pressure, their liver functions, their potassium. Those all have to be checked on a regular basis. So it also depends upon how compliant the patient's going to be.
So you kind of have described the algorithm that we have been hearing for a while, and I kind of wonder about it because, first of all, I don't see a whole lot of evidence. I mean, maybe you can tell me about what there is that adding docetaxel adds anything when you're using ADT and antiandrogen or ADT plus abiraterone. What evidence do we have that, I mean, everybody does kind of what you just said, but do we have evidence for it?
No. What we really need is a three-arm randomized trial of just an antiandrogen versus docetaxel plus that antiandrogen versus docetaxel. And probably will never get done. But if you look at Karim Fazazi, he's got a very, very nice graph where he actually shows the medians, the overall survivals for those patients treated with antiandrogens, treated with docetaxel. They do seem to be similar overall, but when you have both given, there does seem to be some improvement or incremental difference in survival. So, you know, they always train us not to compare phase three studies. This is the best we have at this point, so that's what I'm basing it on.
You know, I guess, I think it was the Enzimet study that kind of looked into this a little bit. I don't remember the exact randomization, but there you saw like a little blip early on, which is kind of what you would expect with chemotherapy. And, you know, you see the same thing, like when you add chemo to an IO as opposed to IO alone, you get a little bump earlier on from the chemo. So, I mean, I could see it if you have somebody who's sick and they need a response, but I see people just giving it to anybody who can tolerate it. And I just kind of wonder, I mean, it seems, particularly for a man who's getting diagnosed, you know, walking in from the door, diagnosed now with metastatic disease, they have to deal with the androgen deprivation, the diagnosis, but now on top of that, docetaxel. And I just, you know, really wonder whether or not, I mean, you could maybe go to the patient and say, well, you know, we don't know for sure it's going to benefit, and then maybe get them involved. But I feel people just give docetaxel. Am I wrong?
No, I don't think you're wrong. I mean, I had a patient just yesterday who we went through each option. We explained, you know, that he had de novo disease. He was young. He was in his 40s. He had low volume metastatic disease, but the de novo was what really, I think, tipped us over. I think that you have to individualize this now without good data in the situation. It has to be individualized and try to apply to each patient individually. A person who's in their 80s, who's frail, is not going to benefit in the long term by giving combined modality therapy. But I think that everybody should be receiving at least an antiandrogen in the situation.
Any sense about whether or not this is actually happening? You know, I know there's a lot of effort to try to figure out what's really happening in practice. Sometimes I see those kind of data and I really wonder if they're accurate or not, because we're talking oncologists all the time. But I have heard people say that they think that endocrine intensification in the hormone-sensitive metastatic disease is underutilized, which really would surprise me. But is that your take?
Yes, that's my take. It surprises me, but also I think that there are several reasons why it may be actually true. Number one is the cost. Some patients have a very large out-of-pocket cost with these particular drugs. I mean, there was somebody yesterday who I spoke to about using darolutamide in the hormone-sensitive state, actually the castrate-resistant non-metastatic state. And he actually had, I think he had about a copay initially of about $5,000 out-of-pocket. And, you know, there are programs for these patients, but there are people who are caught in the middle who are on fixed incomes who really can't afford that amount of money. I mean, it's going to really cause financial hardship. So I think that's probably the biggest factor here.
So you mentioned the Arisens regimen. And one of the things about that that's kind of interesting is that regimen is approved, but correct me if I'm wrong, darolutamide without docetaxel in the hormone-sensitive metastatic setting is not approved. Now, I don't know the reality of whether or not you can give it without chemotherapy. Is it easy to give? And what do you think about that as an option? Do you offer it? If you're going to use an antiandrogen alone with ADT and no docetaxel, do you usually give darolutamide?
Well, we don't have any data. I believe there will be data forthcoming with single-agent darolutamide. Right now, I don't, because we just don't have level one evidence. So we try to, you know, again, tailor the antiandrogen based upon the patient's own clinical characteristics. One of the things I like doing with enzalutamide is giving it at nighttime. Patients, you know, it peaks at night and they're asleep at that particular point. So we've seen less fatigue when it's administered because the label says give it in the morning. Hmm. So that's one thing we wind up doing with our patients. With abiraterone, again, we have to be very, very careful about the cardiovascular history.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Let me ask you, that's really interesting about giving the enzalutamide at night. Do you find people say they sleep better?
Not necessarily sleep better, but they feel better the next day.
Less fatigue. Yeah.
Some of my colleagues have actually taken sort of the opposite approach. Rather than starting them at full dose enzalutamide, they will actually then start half dose and then escalate up. You know, we try to titrate the patient based upon how they're feeling.
We were talking initially about hormonal therapy, and I was curious, all of a sudden I see CDK coming up here, having trials of abemaciclib. What's the thinking in terms of CDK inhibitors in prostate cancer?
Well, it's certainly this analogous to what we're seeing in breast cancer, that you may actually be affecting the signaling that's going on within the cell, inhibiting the CDK4/6 pathway, which may be important to overall resistance with the androgen receptor. So certainly I think it's a valid approach in this disease.
Have you actually used it in any patient at this point?
No, I haven't.
No, I mean, you know, it's being now used in the adjuvant situation in breast. And I guess one of the things from breast, and I guess probably it'll play out with prostate cancer as well, is that it seems like the main issue, side effects-wise, is diarrhea, as opposed to the other CDK inhibitors, where they don't have that much diarrhea, they have more neutropenia. So I assume that's what they're going to see in prostate cancer, but we'll see, I guess. Another thing I want to ask you about, again, before we sort of dive into some of the proven therapies that we're using every day, is the issue of checkpoint inhibitors. You know, obviously you have MSI occasionally, but in general for MSS-stable prostate cancer, so far we're not seeing too much in terms of IOs. I know there are trials, you know, one of the strategies that seems to work in a lot of other cancers, renal cell that you're involved with, is IO plus TKI. And I know, for example, atezo-cabo is being studied in prostate cancer. Any thoughts about the whole idea of checkpoint inhibitors and MSS-stable prostate cancer? Any thoughts about this sort of TKI strategy, whether or not there's any evidence that that might be more beneficial?
Well, the TKIs, particularly cabozantinib, we know that it affects Treg and potentially T-cell trafficking. if one looks at a biopsy specimen of prostate cancer, there are T cells there, but they're not really at the same frequency as we see in other more inflamed tumors. So there are some inflamed prostates, and particularly the MSIs are the ones that we see this in. So I think the TKI approach is interesting. The other interesting observation that I saw at this ASCO GU meeting was looking at the bispecific antibodies, particularly where the CD3 PSMA construct, there's a lead-in to the addition of the checkpoints. And you generally don't see a PSA response when you're leading in with that molecule, but you only see a PSA response when the checkpoint is added, at least in the phase one experience. So it may be the same type of situation where you're trafficking T cells into the prostate cancer and then adding the checkpoint and allowing that to become active. It's fascinating. And I believe Mark Stein presented some of that data at ASCO GU this year.
Wow, that is amazing. CD3, which of course we have a bunch of bispecifics with CD3 trying to pull in T cell, but combining with PSMA, that sounds really amazing. I'm kind of curious, this thing about leading in with a checkpoint inhibitor before a bispecific, has that been done with other bispecifics, hematologic cancers, et cetera?
That, not to my knowledge. It's usually the bispecific first, then the checkpoint. And this is the way the trial is being designed right now to look at the individual activity. But no, not to my knowledge.
That is really fascinating. Have they seen any responses with this bispecific?
Not with the bispecific alone, but when the checkpoint's added.
Really? Wow.
Yeah.
Is that right? Just PSA or any actually objective tumor shrinkage?
To my recollection, there was objective tumor responses. So, yes, there were. I believe so.
And they get cytokine release, same thing as with other bispecifics, CD3?
Right. This has been a problem, but it seems to be under good control.
Yeah, the hematologic ones sound like probably they're going to end up in the community in the outpatient setting, at least some of them anyhow. But that's really cool about prostate. Well, let's talk about castrate-resistant disease and in the metastatic setting. You know, you can imagine a patient going through the Arisens regimen and then having disease progression. The question is, what's next? So, you know, they kind of run through a bunch of things pretty fast there. How do you think that situation through?
Well, certainly I don't usually administer another next generation antiandrogen after the first one. Generally, the responses in the castrate resistance state are short if they do occur. I would assume that the same thing is going to happen in the castration sensitive state. So chemotherapy is a little bit different because it's a course of 6 treatments. So the question is, can you re-induce a patient with docetaxel at that point, or should you give cabazitaxel? I actually prefer giving cabazitaxel because of the toxicity issues. I think it's a less toxic drug. Patients tolerate it better. So that's really, I think, one option at that point. Of course, the second is to check their sequencing, their next generation sequencing. If they have a DNA repair mutation, a PARP inhibitor would be appropriate. Additionally, in an asymptomatic patient with non-visceral disease, cipulucil T does also come into play as well, and that's being used in that particular setting. We don't see PSA responses, but we do see an improvement in survival with that preparation, so that should be something discussed with the patient. So I think that there's an opportunity to do clinical trials in this PSA-rising, castrate-resistant after chemotherapy. And I think that's going to be one of the niches that new drugs are going to be evaluated in.
What about the patient with bone-only mets? How do you think through the use of radium?
It's a great question. So we do use it. It depends, I think, upon how quickly they're progressing. Also, it would be great to have a marker to tell us whether somebody would be appropriate for radium or not. The patients we do treat with radium, we image them after their third treatment to be sure that they're not progressing viscerally, because that I've seen that happen in some patients. The other thing I think it's important to recognize is that we do see degeneration to the neuroendocrine component of prostate cancer in these patients. And that's something that has to be treated a little bit differently with a platinum-based compound. The other thing I've been very interested in is some data out of MD Anderson, Paul Korn, and Aparicio, where they've treated with the combination of carboplatinum and cabazitaxel in those patients with extensive nodal or visceral disease and see a fairly good response. That is going to be confirmed in a randomized trial in the cooperative groups in the future. So I think you have to look at the disease characteristics.
For those patients who have a neuroendocrine transformation, I'm curious, you mentioned the use of chemotherapy. Do you kind of treat it like small cell? Do you add in an IO?
So it's not standard at this point, but there are investigations going on with therapies that combine immune therapy with other agents that may enhance the effect of checkpoint therapy.
What about the issue of lutetium, assuming we're going to get it back again? How do you think through where that's going to come in this patient? And also, what do you use first, lutetium or radium?
So one of the factors that we use in selecting lutetium, of course, is the PSMA PET scan. So if a patient is strongly PSMA PET positive, that would help me move towards lutetium PSMA as my first treatment. If they're bone only, then I think it's really going to be dependent upon the amount of PSMA expression. Perhaps less PSMA expression, I would go with radium over lutetium, but I don't have any prospective data with that. But using the PSMA PET scan is one way to distinguish one versus the other. And as, of course, we know with radium-223 that patients with bulky nodal disease are not appropriate. Patients with visceral disease are not appropriate. So again, I think it's going to depend upon the PSMA staining as well as the sites of disease.
Can you talk a little bit about your experience with lutetium? What kind of tolerability issues come up? Also, just the whole taking care of the patient, isolation issues. Anything you might comment on for a doc who's never used the agent?
So you need a dedicated nuclear medicine person to work with. We have some excellent ones at Yale that we work with very closely. The patients that we have been treating, one issue, of course, is their continence. And one has to take extra precaution with the urine. The patients have to be sure that they have a separate bathroom when they do go home, that they take precautions about other members of the family and not exposing them to radiation therapy. It's also important that the patient is competent. We have a patient right now with severe Alzheimer's disease who has metastatic prostate cancer who would not be an appropriate patient for lutetium because we don't know whether he's going to go to the bathroom in a separate bathroom or even be careful with his urine. So that's something that has to be taken care of, noted carefully. So continence and mental status are very, very important overall to the proper care of these patients.
So let's finish out talking about PARP inhibitors. We saw some interesting new data at the GU meeting. Can you kind of talk about where we were in general with PARP inhibitors prior to the GU meeting? What came out there and where we are today?
So PARP inhibition therapy, we had two FDA-approved agents. We have olaparib, which is approved in patients who've received a prior next-generation antiandrogen, and then rucaparib, which is approved in those patients who've received docetaxel, as well as a next-generation antiandrogen. So some very, very interesting data was presented from the TRITON3 trial. So patients were randomized with DNA repair mutations to receive rucaparib or dealer's choice, which could have been a next-generation antiandrogen or could have been docetaxel. The majority of patients received docetaxel. And rucaparib had a superior radiographic progression-free survival over both docetaxel and them more strongly over an next-generation antiandrogen. So that is helping us to move rucaparib up in the treatment algorithm for castration-resistant disease. You don't need to give docetaxel. And this is the first time that docetaxel has been beaten by another agent in a select group of patients. So we also have data from the TALPRO2 study, where K castration-resistant prostate cancer patients who had, in general, not received a prior anti-androgen therapy were randomized to either talazoparib plus a next-generation anti-androgen or the next-generation anti-androgen alone. So the difference here is that in the HRD-negative patients, you did see an improvement in rPFS as well as in the positive patients. That was not seen with niraparib, and it was seen with an rPFS endpoint with olaparib. However, the survival data from olaparib was presented at this meeting, and there was really no major difference in overall survival in the HRD-negative patients. So the question, of course, is it the anti-androgen? Is it the PARP inhibitor? We don't know the answer to this question.
So right now, I'm just kind of curious, in the absence of FDA indications, is that a strategy that you would use, for example, with a BRCA germline patient? Or I should say to you, if you have, let's put it the other way also, if you have a patient, let's say, who's got a BRCA2 germline mutation, where do you think theoretically they should get a PARP inhibitor? Does it matter which one? And right now, where would you like to give it?
So that's a really interesting question. So firstly, all of these studies have, there's some difficulty in applying this to the real world at this point for those patients who've had a prior antiandrogen. So we don't know if, for example, in a BRCA patient, should you continue the antiandrogen and then add the PARP inhibitor? My suspicion is that you're really enhancing the effect of PARP inhibitors in the BRCA2 patients in all three of these particular studies. I think it's questionable what you're doing in the HRD negative patients. And also, we really haven't seen good data in those subsets, particularly ATM, which do very poorly with the PARP inhibitors. And we saw that with the Triton 3 trial, where the ATM specifically was compared to docetaxel. There wasn't much of a difference in the overall rPFS. So are you making those particular subgroups have more efficacy with the combination? We really don't know. So right now, I'm just simply giving the straight PARP inhibitors. There are some toxicity concerns. There seem to be some higher rates of pulmonary emboli in those patients who receive the combination therapy. Additionally, in the TALPRO2 study, we did see two episodes of MDS in those patients who received the combination therapy compared to the control arm. So this is something that, as we move these drugs up earlier and earlier into the course of castration resistance, as well as castration sensitivity, this is something we're going to have to look at in terms of long-term effects on these patients. So I like giving it right at first progression after hormone therapy. It's a targeted agent. We have good evidence, in particularly in the BRCA2s, that these drugs work.
I guess there's been speculation that there's some kind of synergy between hormonal therapy, novel hormonal therapy, and PARP inhibitors. What do we know about that?
Well, it's seen in the laboratory that you do affect the expression of genes that are related to BRCA-ness by giving an anti-androgen. It's also seen with hypoxia as well. So there are a number of different factors that may induce BRCA-ness. And we've actually, at our institution, we looked at cediranib combined with olaparib and compared that to olaparib alone. And we found an improvement in rPFS in a randomized trial that was Joe Kim's work. And unfortunately, this seemed to be limited to the BRCA patients. So we didn't see the same thing in the HRD negatives that we saw in the overall population. So, you know, I think that there are ways that we can go about this to induce BRCA-ness, and that's one with the antiandrogens, the other is with hypoxia. And the question, of course, is there a better combination? Is there a better antiandrogen to use in the situation? Is there a better PARP inhibitor? So, again, we need randomized trials up to determine this.
I'm curious whether you have any patients who, you know, had great benefit from a PARP inhibitor, very prolonged benefit, excellent benefit. Have you ever seen that?
Yes. I mean, I've seen one of our patients who had metastatic disease to the liver be on a PARP inhibitor for about 2.5 years with a good response and do very, very well with it. These are BRCA2 patients. The BRCA2 patients are the ones who do the best and will get the longest responses out of it.
And you view somatic mutations, somatic BRCA, for example, essentially the same from a therapeutic point of view as germline BRCA?
Yes. There's some thought that the germline BRCAs may do a little bit better, but the somatics are, they're pretty much the same as far as I've seen.
And you talked about other alterations, ATM, but what about PALB2?
PALB2 does very well. You know, the numbers are very small. It's not as frequent as the other mutations, but it does very well. So that's again, one of the things we look for in our next generation report.
You mentioned a couple cases of MDS. Has it been looked at a more global level in terms of, you know, the various trials and trying to put together a meta-analysis, et cetera? What do we know about MDS risk at this point?
So there's not much that's out there in the literature on MDS in prostate, but in other tumors like ovarian, there is some data. So one would assume it's going to be very, very similar in these patients.
Right. The other thing that you referred to was the tolerability issues with PARP inhibitors. And I'm curious what your experience has been with men. A lot of what we've heard, of course, is in ovarian cancer, now breast cancer more. And of course, the two big issues there have been cytopenias and GI upset. What do you see in prostate cancer?
So the cytopenias, I think, are the more prevalent in my experience, particularly anemia. Transfusions are required in some patients. In fact, one of our best responders also was a gentleman who had really significant disease in his bladder from his prostate cancer growing into the upwards into the bladder. And he required transfusions initially because of his bleeding. Once we gave the PARP inhibitor, the tumor regressed, the bleeding stopped. So the anemia shifted from the bleeding to the drug itself. So, and he was requiring about one transfusion a month. So that's probably been about the most I've seen in any patient, but generally it's very, very well tolerated. The nausea can be a problem, but not as significant, I think, as the anemia.
What are some of the clinical research concepts that are including PARP inhibitors that you're most excited about? What are some of the ongoing trials? I would assume there's trials looking in, for example, in first-line metastatic setting, but you tell me.
Right. So there are trials that are there's the TALPRO-3 study that's looking at a PARP inhibitor in hormone-sensitive disease, where in addition to the next generation antiandrogens, so that I think is going to be very, very important. We're going to have to watch for toxicities. Now we have a longer disease course. So again, this may be where we see some of the other side effects long-term coming up, particularly myelodysplastic syndrome or other issues with the bone marrow. So that's going to have to be watched very, very carefully and balanced. That I'm extremely excited about. I think that's another way of improving our treatments up front. There are other combinations that are being done with PARP inhibitors. There are ATR inhibitors that may be showing some activity in combination with PARP inhibitors in resistant patients, patients who failed the PARP inhibitor who are BRCA positive or have other DNA repair mutations. So I think those are two very, very exciting areas. The area that's been disappointing is combining a PARP inhibitor with a checkpoint. And that's unfortunately really not panned out. But I think that there are other avenues to pursue.
So when you kind of look across the breadth of prostate cancer right now, both translational research as well as clinical research, what are some of the new approaches that you think maybe have the possibility to come to the clinic in the next few years?
So I think the bispecifics, as I mentioned before, look very promising. There are some new ADCs that look very, very promising as well. I think those two approaches are things that will be moving forward. And the randomized clinical, at least the ADCs are in randomized trials. So I think that these are very promising approaches to pull in. The PROTACs, I'm very excited about. There will be phase 3 trials looking at these agents. either after all treatment or at the beginning of castration resistance. So the question is finding the right niche in the overall algorithm. It's getting more difficult with more drugs being approved and better survivals.
So you have the interesting situation of seeing patients often in second opinion who've been referred in or have been managed by other physicians. Any sort of I'm not going to say mistakes, but things you see people doing, things you see urologists doing, for example, or medical oncologists doing in practice in prostate cancer that maybe you wouldn't do or maybe should be an area for us to focus on in terms of education?
I think we have to really focus on getting sequencing in all of our patients, making sure that we identify those patients who have DNA repair mutations, and then most importantly, identifying those patients who have mismatch repair mutations. I've seen dramatic responses with pembrolizumab. In fact, one case right now is a complete response and has been so for about 2 years. And this patient received chemotherapy with both docetaxel and cabazitaxel, was refractory to both. And then when we actually checked his profile, which had not been checked until we actually saw the patient, we found this mutation. So I think it's important to check this early. I think it's important to explore all of potential clinical trials that patients may be eligible for. And there are windows of opportunity for patients when they're not symptomatic, their PSAs are rising, and that may be the right time to look at an investigational drug because they may be too sick later in the course of their disease. So I think that those are the two most important factors. Always think about clinical trials and always sequence the patient.
So I'm curious, your patient who had the MSI, did you get a TMB? Do you know what it was?
We did. It was, I believe, intermediate.
Interesting.
It wasn't high. It was intermediate.
Will you use an IO? Will you use pembrolizumab in a patient who has a TMB over 10?
I mean, I think it's worth a try. I think this is a biologically select patient. So I think it certainly is worth a try if I have nothing else that will work. We were very, very disappointed with the randomized study of docetaxel plus or minus pembrolizumab, where we saw absolutely no difference in unselected patients. So selecting our patients, I think, does help. There's some data that Pam Sharma has generated looking at ipi-nivo in the MSI, the high TMB patients, that may show some responses. So I think that it's worth a try in those patients, especially if they've exhausted all other options.
I had an oncologist raise the issue of higher TMB levels when you use liquid biopsy, when you for it. He was saying he'd seen a bunch of people who were over 10 with liquid biopsy and they didn't respond or whatever. Do you know anything about that phenomena, high TMB on liquid, falsely high compared to tissue?
I haven't seen that. Usually the tissue correlates with the liquid, but I haven't seen. Well, it certainly also depends upon when in the course of disease you're looking at this, and this is actually very, very interesting because we look at a lot of archival tissue, and perhaps sometimes patients get rebiopsied as they go along, but we actually have a case that developed a somatic BRCA mutation down the line. We had three different biopsies that we looked at. One, of course, at the beginning from tissue. We also looked at germline. We did one liquid biopsy, and then the second liquid biopsy, the patient converted over to a BRCA positive patient, BRCA 2 positive, and he responded to olaparib. So, it's clonal evolution. It only makes sense that over time you're going to see more mutations as the tumor gets more aggressive and becomes more dedifferentiated.
How effective is liquid biopsy at picking up BRCA and other DDR mutations?
It's pretty effective. Again, we had a case report that we published that we saw some discordance between the tissue as well as the liquid biopsy. So I think, again, we have to think in terms of a temporal change. This is evolution. Things get more aggressive. They develop more. They pick up more mutations as they go on. The question is, how frequently should we be doing this? And we don't have a good answer. I will repeat a liquid biopsy if I see a change in disease characteristics. So if somebody develops visceral disease suddenly, if somebody has an accelerated course, I will recheck their liquid biopsy again to see if I find something that's actionable.
Anything that you can look for in a liquid biopsy that suggests small cell transformation?
Good question. If you take a bunch of experts and put them in the room together and ask what the exact biological characteristics of small cell are, you get probably seven different answers if you have seven people. I can't think of something specific for small cell, perhaps neuron-specific enolase, which is just a biomarker. It's really more a diagnosis of biopsy or a clinical diagnosis when you have a discordance between PSA and the overall progression of disease. And then there's some patients who have that discordance, and when you re-biopsy them, they're not small cell. They actually coexist at the same time, so you just may not be hitting the right tissue. But certainly, I think more indicative is the discordance between a PSA rise or lack of PSA rise and progression. There's one case that is actually fairly interesting that we just had recently. It's a gentleman who was diagnosed with an adenocarcinoma of the prostate and subsequently degenerated to a small cell. And his liver was positive for neuroendocrine small cell tumor. And he was referred to us, but he was receiving PSMA PET scans to measure his progress. And his small cell lit up for PSMA. In fact, it was one of the hottest SUVs we've seen with scanning, and he's responded to lutetium PSMA, which is sort of against the grain. So we have to think about this disease as a heterogeneous disease, and you can see very, very different possibilities in terms of your imaging as well as your molecular profiles.
Believe it or not, we actually had a case like that presented by a general medical oncologist, and we were talking the same thing, like what was going on. I guess it's that concept of sort of a mixed tumor. Is that what you're thinking?
Exactly. They exist together. And we're going to see more of this with our successes with our patients because, again, the tumor is genetically unstable and we'll see more unusual sites of metastatic disease and unusual presentations as time goes on.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Petrylak, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today.